Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to listeners old and new. I'm Graham Hunter. You can get an extra big interview plus a documentary special every month and hear all our content free of adverts by signing up as a socio at patreon.com/Graham Hunter. This month, only socios get my big interview with Kev Kilbane. For £2.99 per month, you'll also know you're supporting our show. More at patreon.com/Graham Hunter. Thanks to all our socios. We need your help to do this. We couldn't and wouldn't do it without you. Here's part one of a two-part interview with Paul Dickov, a Scottish striker probably best known for his time at Manchester City. However, today you can hear him talk about starting off at Arsenal, and believe me, a very, very different Arsenal from the one we see right now. Paul will tell you about the list of teams who wanted him as he approached his 16th birthday, and why his dad was so keen on urging him to leave the family home in Livingston in Scotland and go to London to change his life, to change his expectancy. Then it's George Graham, Pat Rice, Tony Adams, Ian Wright. You're going to love these stories. Gunnar or not, it's an inside view of the classic age of Arsenal. Before you hear them, I also want to tell you what Paul is up to now. He's mentoring children in the schools run by the Loras Trust in the Manchester area. The Loras Trust targets sporting as well as academic excellence, and Paul talks to children and teachers in groups and one-to-one about managing sporting development, diet, nutrition, and laying pathways that give the kids at these free schools the best possible chance of being all they can be. We support him. Find out more, if you want, at lorastrust.co.uk. But for now, listen to this interesting, sharp, intelligent, funny storyteller who was once a fine professional footballer. So, the big interview doesn't usually start with me boasting, but I remember when I was allowed into the dressing room where the World Cup winning side was in 2010, I thought to myself, how many Scots? And then I had to count again, because my guest at the moment, Paul Dickov, is one of a hardy band of Scots who have played in a World Cup final, something to which we'll come in a second. Paul, thank you for doing a big interview.
No, thanks for having me.
We only ever interview people that we admire, and you sparked that definitely from quite some time ago. But let's start by talking about, in this episode, we're going to try and tease out your beliefs and your mentality, attitude, which from my perspective you had in abundance, matched with intelligence too. So if I put to you, and I'm going to give you tons of examples of your own life, which you probably know quite well, that I saw not just a competitive mentality, but a bright mentality, and also somebody who, in given big moments in your career, had ice cold mentality. Where did the thing that drove your professional career, talent aside, where did that come from?
I don't know if it's the Scottish in me, my upbringing. Dad was a major influence on me from a young age, always going on to me about being the best you can, how he would never ever have a go at me for doing my best, for trying my hardest, if I made mistakes or I wasn't good enough or things didn't quite, well, not just in football, in my schoolwork, everything that I was doing. And from quite an early age, that was something that he drummed into me. And I remember that probably a big thing, I was about 11 or 12. I was brought up a Celtic supporter at that time. In Scotland, I had Celtic, Rangers, Aberdeen, Dundee United, Hibs, Hearts, all wanting me to go and train with them, all to sign schoolboy forms.
Wait, Aberdeen could have had you.
I'm with Sir Alex and Archie Knox, was the manager
at
the time.
We'll come back to this.
And we'll come back to the Sir Alex thing as well, him being manager at Aberdeen. And my dad had this, look, I had a fantastic upbringing, but not the wealthiest, not in the nicest area sometimes. And my dad just had this thing that if I was going to have a professional career, which is crazy to say at 12, looking back now, 11, 12, 13, because you never know what path you're going to go down, that he wanted to, well, bluntly, get out of Scotland. I believe that I would benefit hugely of getting away from the friendship group I was in at the time, away from any distractions, and going away and actually leaving home and growing up. And I was down at Man United on trials. I was here in Man City.
Gosh.
Tottenham and Arsenal. My first went down when I was 12 years old.
So there's a level of talent at 11, 12, where not only do clubs want to test out the possibility of having your services, but your dad knew, or at least your dad is thinking about a professional career. That's pretty astonishing.
I think it was purely because of the interest in the amount of scouts and the amount of clubs that were calling him up, you know, and that was something he never ever pushed me. He wasn't one of these dads that were living his dreams through me or anything like that. You know, I just think the forenoon on a Monday night, I would be at Helenvale in Glasgow training with Aberdeen. On a Tuesday night, I'll be, I think it was Heriot Watt University, training with Hearts. And on a Wednesday night, I'll be in Edinburgh again, training with whoever. And, you know, it was literally every night. You'd be out, then I'll play my school team on the Saturday, my boys' club team on the Sunday, and that's just the way it was. It does make me laugh now when I hear kids saying they're tired for the amount of football that they play, but that's...
Because you'd have been six or seven competitive games a week.
And training. But you loved that, that's all you knew. You know, and when you weren't doing that, you were out, you know, that literally was jumpers for goalposts. You know, you're out playing. I was, you know, right pain in the backside to my older brother and hanging around with his mates, and I always wanted to play football with them. And
they let you?
Begrudgingly, yeah.
And how did they treat you once you did play?
When I was younger, they used to kick 10 bales out of me, which I think toughened me up a little bit as well. And that was usually my older brother as well, because he didn't want his little brother hanging on with his mates. It wasn't...
Or showing him up.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, that's just the way it was. And I first went down to Arsenal when I was 12. And I realised then, from me sort of 13, 14, being a biggish fish within the clubs in Scotland, going down to Arsenal, it was every school holiday I would go down, that I had a lot to do, because the players that were there were so talented, ability wise, physique wise, compared to me at that time. Quick, strong, because Arsenal had the best of everything else. And the difference between Arsenal and when I went to the other clubs in England was, I remember going to Tottenham, I was back to back weeks, I must have been about 14, and I spent 1 week at Tottenham, and I think I played about 5 minutes football in actual game time, because they had everybody there at the same time. There was about 40, 50 kids all the same age group. When you went to Arsenal, they would stagger it, so there'd be myself, maybe another lad from Scotland, a couple of lads from Ireland, one from Wales maximum, that would integrate in with their under 14s that would be their academy.
They could actually see you, they could watch and let you have some time to show whatever you had.
Yeah, but you got every opportunity to go and do it, whereas at other clubs, I understand why, if everybody's got the same school holidays and they want to have a look at everybody from all over England, Scotland, Ireland and Wales, there's going to be...
But it's kind of, from Spurs' point of view, and others who practice that, it's a kind of scattergun approach.
Yeah, of course it is.
You might miss a gem.
Yeah, you know, and it wouldn't happen now, no doubt about that. But that was the one thing that appealed me at Arsenal. Arsenal came to my parents when I was 14, and he couldn't sign schoolboy forms with an English club until you were 16. And they just, nothing signed, nothing, anything else, just at a goodwill would... I stopped training with the clubs I was doing in Scotland, stopped going to other clubs, and there'll be an apprenticeship there when I was 16.
You said two huge things, or at least it seems that way to me, as I've gone on and learned in my life from my dad. You watch football, you listen to people. One, that your dad at a young age said, so long as you're giving everything you've got, that you're trying to be the best you can, I'll allow you scope for mistakes.
Yeah.
I think that's quite far-sighted, and I also think it's quite unusual.
Yeah, it is, and it's something I took with me all the way through to now, not just through my career. You know, and it's something I drum it into my kids. You know, just if you can be the best you can all the time and work as hard as you can, you will make mistakes, but 9 times out of 10 you'll get it right.
But you've given them freedom to take creative risks.
Yeah, and you've got to put yourself out there to do that, though. You know, and That's one of those. Don't put yourself out there, nothing's going to happen.
And the idea about it's necessary to break the patterns of either Scotland or where you were in Scotland, that's also quite firm, because it effectively means goodbye to a son that for both your parents that have very young age.
Yeah, it was, and it was difficult to start off with. You know, I've came from Livingston, a little town in Scotland, and all of a sudden I'm on my own in London. And first 6 months I hated it. I absolutely hated it, because for a couple of reasons. One, because I missed home, obviously. The second one, I was treading water, because I very quickly realised, I know it started in the Youth World Cup, 1999, under 16, got to the final, scored the goal, the next big thing to come out of Scotland. And I remember going down to Arsenal pre-season and feeling so much out of my depth. But it was the best thing that happened to me, because I went down a little bit cocky. I've just scored the World Cup final, played in front of 70,000 people. And I soon realised in training that if I'd rely purely on ability alone, I wasn't good enough to be in that environment. Because there was some unbelievable kids in Arsenal at that time. A year above us, Andy Cole was probably the best example. And Ray Parlour in my year. And a lot of other very, very talented boys. And I was really struggling, and it all comes back to finding a way and being the best you can. And if I tried to match Andy Cole, for instance, in ability, goal scoring, if I tried to do what he, I couldn't do it. So I had to very quickly find a way, and it all goes back to the work ethic, closing people down, being horrible, being different from everybody else.
You were that self-analytical then. I'm not saying that you know that this comes to you retrospectively. You were, you know, in the lonely time in digs or wherever, you were going through your own head about the things that you had to add or change to keep up or to overtake others.
Absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt, because I think spending a lot of time on your own in digs in a room, you probably have too much time to reflect.
It can go one of two ways.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, a big turning point for me was we played, still the first year, we played Chelsea at London Colney, South East Counties game, and I was sub. First year, struggling a little bit. I was beginning to get a little bit, I hope people say throughout my career, I did a little bit of anger issues on the pitch and in training, but it was through frustration of me not being at the level that the other ones were at. And I was on the pitch about 2 minutes, balls went over the top, and it was Frank Sinclair, funnily enough. I think him and Frank's came from nowhere, and I just lost my head. And looking back, it was funny, it wasn't funny at the time, I just booted him up the bum. Ball was nowhere, I was just that frustrated.
I think the rush of frustration, I think anybody can understand that. Not everybody does it, but I think you're ringing a bell with everybody listening.
And Pat Rice, who's the youth team manager, huge influence on me, Rice, took me straight off. Well, it must have been the pitch about 2 minutes. And we had a chat with all the staff, and they basically said, look, you're here for a reason, we rate you, but you keep doing what you're doing at the minute, we're sending you home. Now, loads of things were going through my head then. One, I didn't want to let my dad down.
No.
I didn't want to let Arsenal down, because they were taking this chance on me. And the embarrassment of going back to my mates at a young age when played in the World Youth Cup final, contract at Arsenal, he's moving away, he's going on to bigger things, and then having to go back and explain why at a young age I didn't want that to happen. And that's when the penny dropped, and everything I was doing in training, in games, and mentally I had to change.
I don't want to be over analytical, but it's given that you were that bright at that age about yourself and about your career and about your surroundings, did you have any idea then that you still had to retain some of that genie in a bottle, that some of that was going to serve you as you went on?
And that's something Pat Rice used to speak to me about all the time as a youth team player. He said, look, we never ever ever want to take that away from you. We've just got to channel it in the right direction and realise that when you do channel it right, that sometimes, all right, you might not be able to do things with the ball that other players can do, but you're as important, if not more important, to the team when you're doing that. Because people, when you channel it right and you do it right, people don't like playing against you, and you'll have a long career. And I remember George Graham at the time, I didn't quite know what he meant, but he had a conversation with me about how I'd have a long career in football. Never said at Arsenal. So I think he probably knew, as much as I was in the squad a lot, and George introduced me to the first team and he loved having me around it. I think maybe that level at that time, when there was the Wrights, the Bear Camps and everything else. But if I kept going the way I was going, I would end up having a long career in the game.
You mate, I'm jumping aside and come back, because I saw in this city a couple of months ago, I was over at the other side. Mm-hmm. And they've got something called the cage at Carrington, where the idea is that 14, 15 year olds are given a kind of all in game. The ball's never out of play. It's at least 8, possibly 11 a side. So it's not like 5 a side with the ball off the walls, but it's in play all the time and it's quick. And while it's refereed, the idea is that it's supposed to reproduce a little bit of street football's attitude. There was one guy who was astonishing, and there'd been a couple of hefty tackles, and he took the ball and he drifted past his fullback, and in the same movement of the ball tied to his foot, did him just say, don't mess with me. And I saw the coaches who'd set up this atmosphere saying, oh yeah, I'm not like that, and then you're off, because they had to say, that's too much, you're off. But they were bubbling with,
but they loved
it. Oh, that's the right stuff. But like with you, also when you're told, when you're full of testosterone and will to win, and you're told, don't kick him out the bum or whatever it is, or how it's all very well now saying Pat told you channel it. How do you do that? Because that comes with maturity, which you're not really supposed to have at 16.
I had to grow up very quickly, and I think being away from home, being in London. You know what I'm saying? It was the world's apart from where I got brought up in. I think you have to get streetwise very quickly, and you have to grow up very quickly, otherwise you just get lost.
Did Livingston make you streetwise? You said there were things to move away from.
Yeah, look, I had mates that were wrongings, or probably a little bit of a wronging myself at times, and was I the model child? Was I the model kid in school? No, I wasn't. I was in trouble quite a lot, actually. But that's not something that I felt I took down to London with me, and I completely understand my dad's reasons for wanting to do it, because the mates I was playing football with, the mates I was growing up with, were either ended up not doing very well for themselves or still doing the exact same thing now as what they were doing when they were 13, 14, 15.
It's a depressing thought, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a bright, it's some guy, your father in that case. You're also in an atmosphere where we have to talk about Pat, we have to talk about George. Pat I know less, George I know very well indeed. To what degree did you have to mix with some of the all-time characters of British football?
Very, very quickly. And this is what separates, and go back a little bit as well, separated Arsenal from everybody else. I remember going down, my mum and dad, and Terry Murphy, who's what a guy, overseen Arsenal's youth system for seemingly like forever, would take you out, and all of a sudden you would bump into David Rocastle at the stadium. It was all pre-planned. Thinking back now, David Rocastle would come over, oh, how are you doing, this is a great club, God bless him, what a guy.
Yeah, loved by everybody.
Speak to your parents, and even the senior pros, when you were in that environment, were always like that. When you were one-on-one with them, and the advice they got, I know they took the Tony Adams, the Merce, the Bolds, every single one of them were big, big characters, but they helped you. They helped you by talking about being cruel to be kind sometimes, talking about kids nowadays not cleaning boots and cleaning the changing rooms. I used to have a mini panic attack whenever I walked in the first team dressing room. 2-1, because you were that scared of them.
I think that's fair.
And 2, you had that much respect for them as well.
Yeah.
And they were up there, and that's where you wanted to go. And you used to walk in, you used to pick the boots up, and you'd get a slap in the head. You'd get somebody would boot you up the bum, and somebody would say, what are you doing? Get out of here. You're not in the first team there. All that sort of stuff. So everything combined, it toughens you up.
It's an atmosphere that can't exist today.
Unfortunately,
I think wouldn't be allowed.
There's a certain level of it that can't, but I think there's certain things that you could take out of it without a shadow of a doubt. Because you speak to anybody, not just in that youth team at the time, but anybody that went through that as a player, that will say there's some of the best times of your career. The camaraderie you got with your teammates, and you had to go back on a Friday afternoon and clean the changing rooms, get the kit out, get the boots out. Then after a match day, everybody's gone home, you're scrubbing the floors, tiles, toilets. And if they're not done right, Pat Rice would have us in at 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning to redo it all again. So that discipline side of it, that you don't realise at the time, the togetherness it gives you with your teammates.
Tell us a little bit about Pat, because given that I'm older than you are, I remember Pat as fullback, Sammy Nelson, I think, probably in the double winning side. Yeah. At one stage, he'd have probably been at or near all time appearances for Arsenal, kind of Mr. Arsenal. Kept by Arsene, and therefore, if he's not still there, it's very recently. And
I think maybe he's still there.
But he's not a very public character. No, he doesn't speak in public very often. Paint a picture of Pat Rice and who he is and what he did for you and what kind of man he is.
Very hard man. but with a soft side to him as well. He knew, even as kids, he knew how to get the best out of each individual one. He would look after you with his life, whether he liked you as a person or not, to try and give you the best pathway that you could get in your career. You know, he would bollock you, mm-hmm. and he would properly bollock you.
Mm-hmm.
I remember him taking me off in an FA Youth Cup game, and I swore at him. And just in the heat of the moment again, and I was never been so scared in my life in the changing room afterwards, because he told me to shred, and he was right. And he would, man, I made sure it was something I'd never ever done again, mm-hmm. all the way through my career.
Irishman,
yeah.
Funny?
Very funny as well. You know, he had a bit of everything to him. A fantastic coach. But you look at the players he produced, you know, I've already spoke about Mersh, David Rocastle, Michael Thomas, Martin Hayes in the first team, Tony Adams, and Ray Parlour, who I played with, you know, and Stephen Morrow, Ian Settle. You know, the amount of players that Pat produced that went on to win big trophies, it must be up there with the best, phenomenal. And that's because he grounds you, mm-hmm. and he coaches you well, and he teaches you how to be a footballer more than anything else.
And he was working for it, although you must have started going down, was Terry Neill big boss when you first went down? Because you going down at that age, you predated George by
Terry and Don Howe.
Don was a coach too.
Yeah. And that's the other thing, you know, even though you're a schoolboy, Pat Rice would take your training.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't an under 14 coach or an under 13.
Did you know who he was at that stage? A bit, by name maybe.
The first time I went down, obviously you find out about the scout that brings you down and tells you this is what's going to be happening. But then to have the boost as a young kid, to have the youth team manager that's coming to take you. You know, it was loads of little things that Arsenal done properly.
Mm.
You know, it's a bit best, not just football education, probably life education that I've got.
George Graham. Because Pat and George were teammates in the Dublin. George is Hollywood. George is elegance, isn't he?
Yeah.
George, one of the things that we found out, I don't know if you know this, but George and Terry Venables were so close that George was best man to Terry in his wedding on the Saturday morning of a North London derby. Mm,
that's right, yeah.
And then George went out and spanked Terry 4-0.
Yeah, that's right.
You're like, it's like something out of Butch and Sundance. It's definitely from the Hollywood era. But like spruce and elegant,
immaculate.
Strong and bright and
intelligent.
Give us your picture of George Graham then.
Now or then?
Definitely let's start with then, because I suspect it's a changed picture.
Just utmost respect, you know, even from a young age. I think when you're in the youth team and you look how much the first team players respect the manager and listen to the manager, you know that the guy's something special. You know, he was very hard to mustard. Admit, and I've never spoken to him about this, you might ask him, he did have a little soft spot for me. Good. I think the Scottish boy coming down to England 16, he'd done the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, so I think he knew the sort of things I was going through. It was tough in me.
Uh-huh.
But I knew he liked my attitude and my enthusiasm and my love for the game and the fact I was so focused on wanting to be a footballer. You know, he never came out and told me that, but I knew that was the one thing that he liked about me.
Because he had the first team feeling as you felt about the first team.
Yeah.
I think Tony called him the eye at all, I think, and they were scared to go in and ask for extra money.
Yeah.
And George was very canny. He always seemed to be a step ahead of them all the time.
Yeah, and I remember, I think it was my first professional contract. It was YTS then, so the first year I was on £27.50. Second year, I got the raise to £35. I thought I was minted.
Come on.
You know, and
I'd still take that.
And I got the call to meet manager back at the stadium,
right?
And as any young pro did do, I'm not so much they do it now, they go to the senior pros and ask their advice.
Sure, give me the numbers.
Now, whether the lads were taking a complete piss out there or not, I don't know. So I went and spoke to them, and they're saying, look, we'll tell you what the gaffer will do now. It's your first contract, he'll offer you £200 a week. Don't take it, go and ask for five.
From 27,
£35.
£35.
He said, ask for five, settle for four. But he done it to me, he done it to him, look at him. They're all going, yep, same thing. So I've travelled back from London, calling me back to Highbury. Can't even say it was 2 o'clock, I had to see the gaffer. Walked up the marble staircase, up to his office. And his door for the office was bigger than this room. Right, and I've chapped, and he's, wait. So I'm sitting outside, and I'm thinking, go on, five. Must have been sitting there for about an hour. And I know for a fact now, He wasn't doing anything.
Doing the crossword.
Yeah, he was probably reading the paper or something else. Eventually I went in, and I swear to God, I've walked in, right, and he's got this. At the time, it looked like an altar for his desk. And this big, massive chair that's up here. Yeah. And he's went, sit down. And then the little nursery chairs, yeah. That's what it looked like. Yeah. So I went in, and I'm sitting like this.
Peeking up
at him. And he went, I'll give you 2 years at £200 a week. I went, okay. And turned around and walked straight back out again. But that's the thing.
We've got to admire that in retrospect.
Absolutely.
That is genius, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Oh, man.
You know, whether he'd done that with everybody else.
I think he did with Tony.
Or, yeah. But it was genius.
Fabulous.
But away from all that, it wasn't, not easy. It wasn't about the money. I was just so glad that I was getting involved in the first team squad a lot more as a kid. And
yeah, to have his faith, to have him saying you'll be
for
him
to give me a professional contract, where a lot of the lads who were saying were more talented than me in the team, we weren't getting them, you know.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We're coming back to Arsenal, but let's take a jump because I did... You've already answered my question about mentality brilliantly. I'm not used to being carpet pulled from underneath me in the first 15 minutes of the chat, but you know, anybody of my age was vaguely aware of you at Arsenal, but at that stage, you know, I think you were still a year or two away from a first team debut.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, FIFA have the common sense to put a world tournament in Scotland, part of which was at Pittodrie. I know what I want to get from you about your feelings or your reactions to the moments, but was it as special as you would imagine in that a World Cup is or even a European Championship for which Scotland used to qualify? Part of the magic is probably going to a foreign country, seeing all the things you've never seen before, that excitement of being invaders in a foreign country, but you're at home.
Yeah.
Was that good or bad to be, you know, living in normal conditions, basically back home for a World Cup?
We didn't really think about it.
Oh.
Honestly, we'd been, and I look back at it now, the European Championships just before which were held in Denmark, which was a great experience because we'd done the travelling thing, we were away together, it was a proper camp that we were doing. And it was obviously all done with the lead up to the World Cup. So when we went and made our base at Largs at the time, we went there and we were all together for 2 weeks. We just had that in a difference. You know, it wasn't anything new, and if anything it wasn't, we weren't at home every day. I think we get let home twice over the course of the 2 weeks, but it was just brilliant. You know, we were a group of lads that loved playing football, and I think that showed, and that's one of the reasons we went as far as we went in the tournament.
It took a little bit of time for the buzz to grow in the country, didn't it?
Yeah, I remember played Ghana in the first game at Hampden, and I think there was about 6,000 or 7,000 there. You know, maybe that's shouldn't have been played at Hampden, maybe they should have took it to the second game is Fir Park.
Yeah.
Where we played,
was it Bahrain? Or?
Bahrain. Next 2 games were at Fir Park. Crowd was there was about 7,000 there again, but smaller.
Feels not bad.
Yeah, and then Cuba was the third game at Fir Park, and don't know what the crowd was, but it looked as if it was full, you know. And then obviously we qualified, which was great, and we just went on the crest of a wave after that. You know, we didn't expect to get out the group. Never mind.
Really?
Yeah, that sounds. The Bahrain team were fantastic footballers. The Ghana team, they were the up and coming kid called Neil Lamptey.
Oof, what a player
he was, but at that age as well, you know. So the Ghanaians had a lot of big names, even though it was supposed to be under 16 Youth World Cup. So we just went with it and had a go, and you know, obviously Craig Brown was a manager, and Ross Matthey, and they just kept giving us the confidence to go out and play, go and play, go and play, enjoy the crowd, and no pressure on you, nobody's expecting anything. And before we knew it, we were playing in front of 30,000 at Tynecastle against Portugal.
Well, that's the semi-final, eh? Yeah. Now that, because by that
stage, I won't miss Pataudry out in the quarter-final. Okay. It's all right. Don't.
So was that East Germany?
East Germany, yeah.
So Pataudry, obviously a raucous welcome. It feels like the Maracanã. Yeah. Beautiful night by the sea, or not? But Tynecastle is different because you've presented it very matter-of-factly, very cleanly and clearly up to now. But my memory serves me well. Tynecastle is buzzing. It's difficult to get to. The atmosphere is fantastic.
Well, we're late getting to the ground because the crowd. It was phenomenal. It was just that everybody had come out. You know, Scotland's in this Youth World Cup semi-final and playing against Portugal. And some of the names that Portugal team had that went on to a little Luis Figo.
Let's pick one.
Yeah, Figo was the one. Abel Xavier as well was centre half that day. And we'd actually stayed in the same base as the Portuguese at the European Championship in Denmark.
Okay.
And we watched them playing games and they were some team. But we just thought, you know what, we'll go out there. We're Scottish, don't expect to be here. Kick them, harry them, force them into mistakes. And that's what happened. But the crowd, going back to the crowd, I think there was 6,000 locked out, 30,000 in. There was people on the roof watching the game, and it was just, you know, such a special night. Got into that.
Do you have family and friends there?
Everybody was there, yeah. Everybody was there. And then you've got, before you know it, Brian O'Neill scores 1-0, and we actually deserve to win the game. And then the next thing you know, you're 15 and under 16, and you're going to a World Cup final in your own country.
There's a tale to tell about that, but I think, you know, given that you're so honest, that at that stage, internet, I don't know if it even exists.
No.
At that stage, Figo hasn't won the Ballon d'Or. He's not Real Madrid Figo. Yeah. He's not Milan Figo. Did he stand out? Did you go, that's the 17? Or also, you know, he famously was sort of a child of the 60s when he won the world title with a hair down here. Did he stand out at that stage? Or because, I wondered if...
You wouldn't have said then that he was the one that said would have went and done it.
He just looked like an able footballer at that stage.
Yeah, good footballer and really nice lad as well. You know, talking about being in that same base in the European Championship.
There was a degree of 16. Camaraderie and mixing.
Yeah, absolutely. But you wouldn't have said he would have been the one that was going to be the world superstar that he was.
Well, in the podcast with him, we'll ask him what happened. Yeah. So, Hampden has to be a bittersweet tale. But let's go to sweet, because when we looked at you, both of us reacted a little bit to, I'd put it in my words, as pigeonholing.
Yeah.
You've used a couple of phrases about nasty and kicking and chasing, and I don't know, okay, fine. But what we continually saw was football intelligence and a work ethic and a mentality. Yeah. At least that's what I think I saw, a winner's mentality.
Yeah.
And you get your goal from a mix of everything that's you at hand, and I'll let you describe it. But I remember it as being 50% dogged, I know what I'm going to do and I'm not going to let the situation get away from me because that ball's not mine. And then when you get the ball, again in my view, I think you do something pretty special.
Yeah.
So take us back to where we're at in the match. Scotland are 1-0 up.
1-0 up. Ian Downey.
Against Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I know. I got an assist, Ian Downey's header, and then I hadn't scored all tournament. I played really, really well. I missed chances, I was unlucky, and there was this big thing getting into the final about me not scoring in the tournament yet. I remember the ball got played down the channel, chased the centre half down, centre half slipped. The centre half was that far in front of me, the goalkeeper was already sort of coming out for him to pass it back where they could.
Don't do yourself a disservice. Say he's got the ball, and you're a good bit back in it.
Yeah.
He should have been smoking a cigar.
Yeah, I think he was old enough to, wasn't he?
we haven't rushed that.
And I've nicked the ball off him, and then, you know, people say to me, and they say this about a lot of goals, what do you remember about it? What was going through your head? It's just instinct, a lot of it.
But your angle's not great.
I could see it was off his line, but it was also out his box as well. Mm. So... if I can say I thought I'm going to chip him because his ear is there, I would be lying. It just happened, and
something takes over.
Yeah, it does, and it's weird to explain, Graham. You know, it just happens, and then sometimes afterwards you think, how did I do that? You know, when you see it back, and
because I also think, and whether it's modesty or memory, I do think you're underplaying that a little bit, because when you pick the ball up, you're fairly far wide, right? Even though instinct takes over and he's a little bit off his line, you can't see a lot of the goal. It's quite an oblique angle to the right with the goal diagonally to you, not in front of you. And it wasn't like the goal that Villarreal scored at the Bernabeu, mm-hmm. Where you're front on the keeper's off and you approach it and it's just an up and down. You know, it's not an easy Sunday bunker shot. It's a really tough shot.
But I used to work. I used to mum my finishing all the time. Uh-huh. All the, even from a young age. You know, if I knew that I loved scoring goals. You know, and I loved being in that position to do it. And even at an under 16 level, I firmly believe that me being out with a ball at my feet every day that I could makes that these sort of things happen. You know, because you work at it and you practice it and you visualise things in your head and you know, you want to be. I wanted to be Kenny Dalglish when I was a kid. You know, the best, one of the best players ever, not just Scottish players. And I would watch how he would do things, and I would go out and try and do the same things, and then I do believe you get the benefits from it. And you know, that goal at a young age in a World Cup final, I do think stems from that. And I'll go back and say, did I know what I was doing? Did I think I've got a chip? No, I didn't. It just happens, and it's hard to explain.
So a Gary Player, Jackie Stewart, the harder I work, the luckier I get.
Yeah, absolutely.
So matches can come and go, and Scotland are 2-0 up and it ends 2-2.
Yeah.
The first thing to say is that retrospectively there's been a bit of a hoo-ha, and we've joked about it, about the ages of the Saudi players, and there have been accusations that they cheated and some. Isn't the evidence of your own eyes or what they were like on the day, what were you thinking, or what were any of your teammates thinking?
I remember just walking out the tunnel and standing beside them before the game and thinking, they are massive. Being honest, at the time, was I thinking they must be 25? We weren't. We just thought they were a big, powerful team, which we knew. We knew they would come on strong towards the end of the game. But regardless if they were 17, 18, 19, I mean, there's been accusations some of them were 25.
I've seen that one.
You know, we should have won the game, regardless.
Ah.
2-0 up. They get back to 2-1. We miss a penalty. Should have went 3. Game over. Game over. And we were good enough up until a point to have won that game quite comfortably. The fact that they got back in the last 10-15 minutes was purely they were physical, they were fitter, they were bigger, they were stronger than us, and we tired through the exertions that we'd done previously. But away from all that, we should have won that game.
It's a brilliant mentality. So does that leave you with less of a soreness about not having had that medal, because you know that whatever they did, even if they did bend the rules a little bit, it was within your own grasp? At least you haven't just sort of been outright robbery.
We're 2-0 up going into the second half. And as I say, Brian O'Neill, bless him, you know, a young, he misses a penalty in the 90 minutes and then misses the penalty that causes in the penalty shootout. You know, and talking about mentality, for Brian at a young age to come back from that and go and have the career they had is bang on.
Aberdeen legend.
Yep, he is that.
Nice man, too. Very nice man.
Top man.
Successful in the Bundesliga, too. Yeah,
very well.
So hats off to Brian, a really nice fella. So you go back to Arsenal. This isn't going to be a life in chronology. Yeah. But I think it's bookends.
Yeah.
How were you treated? Did English fellas dig you up a little bit? Because if they didn't, and I don't believe you.
The one thing I can remember going back there was Theo Foley, who was assistant manager at the time, coming over and congratulating me. Obviously, the gaffer was buzzing that Scotland had done so well. A lot of the first team players hadn't watched it. A lot of them didn't even know about it. You know, because at that time, they were all on holiday. You know?
Okay.
You know, it's close season, and I suppose it's not like now where you can go into any bar anywhere in the world and you can watch the Premier League can watch any game that you want. The only player that mentioned it was Quinny, Niall Quinn.
All right.
And lovely guy anyway, Quinny. And he came over to him, made a big thing about it. And I was sitting in a bar in Marbella or wherever it was. They said, and I'm sitting on my holidays, and I look up and I see you playing, what a goal you scored, well done, and da-da-da, and that straight away you're like,
feels good.
Yeah, because senior pro you look up to.
Because there were two of you in that squad, James Will.
Three, Scott Marshall.
Scott was also
Scotty,
Arsenal.
Yeah.
Oh, well, so if it came to sort of a standoff, it could have been 3v3 if anybody would be taking the piss.
Exactly.
And you go back then in that case, what, probably a little bit more determined?
A little bit more determined, probably a little bit too cocky, if I'm being honest. And, you know, that, maybe it's a little bit back to front this, but the Pat Rice incident when he took me off, that was all around the same time. Like, it all just happened after, because I signed for Arsenal on the 1st of January 1989. I actually left school early, and I had that from the January to the May in 1989 as a settling-in period, if you know what I mean. And Scott and Jim weren't there. My year group was the next year group that was coming in, if that makes any sense.
It does, totally.
So when I went back that pre-season, that was my first real time there, if
it,
you know
what I mean. It was beginning again, even though you'd been there for...
Yeah, okay. And I probably went back as a cocky little Scotsman, thinking, do you know what, if I'm looking back now, I'd probably think, do you know what, I've made it here. I'm at Arsenal, I just scored a World Cup final, and hence all the other things started to happen.
So once the re-education helps you, you do begin to make an impact, and you do begin to play for Arsenal. Is it because it wasn't meant to be? Is it because the competition you faced was outrageous? Is it because of outside elements that you didn't do maybe 5, 6, 7 years as an Arsenal first team player? Because it does seem in retrospect that it could have been that way. You could have probably, what you proved later in your career... attitude, work ethic, ability to score, team mentality. It could have happened.
Yeah, I got to the point where I was 22. Obviously, George had left, Bruce Rioch had come in. Then Bruce had left, Arsenal was taken over. And talking about that actual time, I had to realise, 22, I'm not a regular in the first team. I'm not playing, I played. I think I'd made about 16, 17 starts, 20-odd sub-appearances, travelling with the squad, being... 15th man, whatever it was at the time, on the bench, off the bench, and in cup games coming out. And I, deep down, I knew that at some point I was going to have to move on. It was difficult because all my working career, from when I was 16, 7 years, living on my own, growing up, life experiences, football education, had all been at Arsenal. I didn't know anything different. But it came to a point where I just wanted to play, you know, and I just wanted to make a career for myself, and if I'd stayed any longer, I don't think I would have done. You know, Arsene was just taking over. I don't know if you remember at the time, he was at Grand Passé. Mm-hmm. He had to finish his contract at Grand Passé, although he'd been announced as Arsenal manager.
That's right.
And through Stuart Houston, who was the caretaker at the time, Stuart came to me and said, look, Arsene would like you to stay. He wants to say good things about you. I've obviously spoke. He wants to have a good look at all players, not just yourself. But he does realise, because I've been speaking to Stuart, Jordy Armstrong, God bless him as well.
Oh, another legend. So, like Rocky, so
what? What a guy.
How did you come into so much contact with him?
Jordy was my reserve team manager
for
about 4 seasons. Mm-hmm. Just brilliant. We used to argue in training. He used to cheat all the time. The ball would be 5 yards out. And if he was joining in, he would play on. And do you know what I mean? And
I think that's good for you.
It was brilliant. And I'd been speaking to Jordy and Stuart a lot and just saying, look, I need to go and play now, you know, and they were agreeing with me. And Stuart said, Arsene's not going to leave the decision down to you. And I was actually getting ready to leave Colney to go down and sign for Southampton under Graham Souness. And Jordy called me and said, look, I'm Alan Ball. He's just called me from Man City. And I knew whether Alan Ball called Jordy or Jordy, because we got on so well and he had a soft spot for me. Probably called Bolly, I think.
Looking out for you a little bit.
Saying, look, he's going down just to mark your card. I know you like him. There you go. And before I knew it, I was in Mottram Hall with Franny Lee and Alan Ball signing the contract. And that was just as quickly as it happened.
Before we leave Arsenal, there's two things. You've got a Cup Winners' Cup medal.
Yeah.
What do you think of it? Is it mine? Is it not mine? Is it?
It's...
Footballers think about these things differently.
Yeah, it's something. Look, I'm proud, so proud of it. But I never made an appearance in the tournament, you know. But it all goes back to I genuinely believe hard work, you know. And the 6 weeks previous to the actual final, I was playing for Brighton in the Old Third Division on loan at the Goldstone, you know. And I'd actually played against Fulham on the Saturday. Obviously, Fulham not the Fulham that used to be or are now. They were struggling. Scored 2 goals in front of a packed Goldstone. What a ground. There's so great memories of there for the short space of time. And got a phone call to say I was getting called back because I was in the European Cup Winners' Cup final squad on the Tuesday night. So from the Saturday playing in the Division 3
to the European final against traveling to fabulous Parma side back to Denmark.
Yep, Copenhagen. And the squad. And I did think somebody was taking the piss, you know, the old yeah good one on the phone. Before I knew it, I was on the plane to Copenhagen.
Did the mentality click in? I might be called upon, this might be my moment.
I didn't think for 1 second I was going to be in the squad, as in the actual make the bench. You know, and I remember George naming the subs in the team meeting, and I wasn't even, I think I was in dreamland, so I was thinking about something else. It, just pure, honestly, expecting my name not to be there. And the last name, the sub, was Paul Dickov.
You know, at which point?
I was buzzing.
In the adrenaline?
Yeah, I couldn't wait to get there. You know, I think I was out in the pitch in Copenhagen warming up about 4 hours before everybody else. I just couldn't wait to get out there, and you know, the fans were singing my name behind the goal as I was taking shots into the goal before.
Come on.
I was living the dream, you know. It was,
no way.
Yeah. And,
well, that makes the medal shine a little bit more brightly.
But also, it just shows you that anything can happen.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm willing to bet, it's an easy bet to make, but I'm willing to bet that had you been called on, you'd have been ready that day.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And my memory of that side was, Arsenal weren't really supposed to win.
No, because the Zolas, the Asprias, the team.
Partner could play.
The team
could really
fantastic,
play.
Fantastic, yeah.
That performance that day was just heroic. To me, it spoke of the majority of the European performances from the British sides over the previous couple of decades. It doesn't matter about the odds or how good the other side. There's something about our unity, work rate, mentality. It was also quite. It was one of George's defensive days.
Yeah. His tactics were brilliant, as they always were. You know, and the actual game itself, I can't remember much about because I think I warmed up for 90 minutes. I was knackered at the end of it. I was just that desperate to get. I kept running past George. I just, Gaffer, I'm here, I'm ready, sort of thing. You know, but getting called up and put in that squad was, I remember George, I remember Stuart saying to me that was a reward for how hard I'd been working. You know, and if you look back with George, he'd done it with Stephen Morrow, he'd done it with Ray Parler, FA Cup. League Cup final.
Didn't end up well for Steve, but nonetheless.
No, I know, but there was always a youngster that get put on the bench, and that was his way of saying.
I'm damn glad that you feel that way about the experience. I really am, because obviously it's not everything that you'd have wanted for yourself in that moment.
At that
but
time,
it's everything that everybody who's listening to this wants.
Yeah, no, it was. Yeah, of course it was. You know, if I hadn't had that time at Arsenal, I doubt I would have went on to the career I would have had. You know, because the characters I was dealing with.
Well, I can't leave Arsenal without one of them. Of all the people that you've talked about, did Ian Wright influence you, help you,
hugely.
Drive you mad, make you laugh?
Everything. I love him to bits. But Wright, he couldn't play in the final, so I did offer Wright in my middle.
Oh, I didn't know that.
After the game, yeah.
That's a fabulous gesture.
Because, as I said before, I hadn't even kicked a ball in the tournament.
Yeah.
I seen how devastated Wright he was when he got his booking against PSG, knowing that he was going to missed the final and the semi-final, and he was just a huge influence. They fathered me, slapped me about a bit, took the piss out of me, but loved me at the same time. And the biggest thing that happened at Arsenal for me that I took all through my career was my writing. I was finished training at London Colney, dressed, walking over for lunch, and Wrighty's walking, it's hard to imagine what Colney was like, but Wrighty's walking back out to the training pitches, and he's got two bags of balls over his shoulder, 20 balls in each, and he's went to me, "Where are you going?" And I went, I'm just sort of laughed and said, "I'm going for my lunch." And he went, "No, you're not." I said, "You're not good enough." And he went, "Go and get training kit on and come out with me." Unbeknown to me, and maybe a lot of his teammates at the time, every day, most days, he would go out on his own with two bags of balls and just hit the back of the net. No goalkeeper, no opposition, no nothing. So we went out, and he would hit the ball from 20 yards, 18, 6, 2 yards, and just. And I remember him saying once at that time, he took a shot and he went, "Did you hear that?" And I was thinking, "He's daft, there's nobody here." And he went, "Did you hear that?" And I went, "What?" He went, "The ball hitting the back of the net, swish." He said, "It's the best sound ever." So, what that taught me, going back to my digs that day, was that this is best striker in the Premier League at the time. He'd just won the European Golden Boot. England's goal scorer, best natural instinctive goal scorer there was at the time.
There was a big difference between the two of them. Yep. I know who I'd pay to watch.
Yep.
Righty.
Yep, 100%. And he stays out every day doing that. Mm-hmm. Why does he do it?
So when you heard tales latterly about the Cantona effect on the class of 92, you understood it immediately.
Oh, 100%, because Righty used to do that anyway.
He's a strange picture for people that haven't lived through this. When I first moved to Barcelona, Ronaldinho was signing, and in those days the pitch next to the Camp Nou, it was where you could watch them training. And Ronaldinho used to go down on his own. He used to be like Wrighty, and they wouldn't give him a goalkeeper.
Yeah,
he'd ask for a goalkeeper. They'd go, "Don't be stupid." Mm. And I don't know why he didn't bully. He didn't do a Wrighty on it. The club wasn't set up to help Ronaldinho, what Ferran Soriano called it, our rock and roll signing. Mm-hmm. So they knew what to do in signing him, they knew who to play him with, they knew how to market him, but nobody supported him.
Yeah.
So at that stage, nobody at Arsenal was saying, brilliant, right, he's going out, we'll get the junior keeper, will be there, we'll make everything. You know, it was all on you.
It was all on you to do it, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. I don't know if you went to a coach or you went to. If I went to Bob Walsh, the goalkeeping coach, and go, can I do something with your keepers today? He would stay out and he would do it with you. I said to Pat Rice, I need to work on this. They would come out and do it with you. But a lot of it, you've done it yourself. Not like kids nowadays.
That's the motif. The whole career thing is do it yourself. Do it right. Yeah, do it over absolutely. And over again. Do it yourself.
Yeah, and that day with Wrighty was just brilliant for me going through my career.
It's fabulous because here, at this, we're at Manchester City right now. Here, Pep will be talking to, and the Spanish players who are really, really good, all talk about automatismos. Mm-hmm. Automatismos means something becomes automatic.
Yeah.
And it just happens, and usually for the good.
Yeah, absolutely. And from that day on, every day after training, I used to have managers screaming at me to come in on a Friday. And I'd say, no, I need to. And Mark Hughes and Mark Bone was at Blackburn, used to say to me, just don't do anything, you've worked hard enough this week.
But on the basis that you might use all your powder.
Yeah.
And which you could say about running, but not about skills.
No, I would do it properly. I would do it properly, in effect. It was match pace, it was intensive, it was sprints. It was. I needed to come off the training ground knowing I was sweating, knowing I'd done what I needed to do. And knowing that it wouldn't affect me on the Saturday.
So, thank you to Mr. Paul Dickoff for the interview. And for the off-microphone follow-up in Rincón de Rafa in the Deansgate, Manchester, that followed this podcast recording. Thank you also to all our friends at Manchester City, especially Alex Rowan in the media department. You can get an extra big interview, plus a documentary special every month, and hear all our content, advert-free, by signing up as a socio at patreon.com/GrahamHunter. For just £2.99 per month, you'll also know that you're supporting this show. Independent football podcasting, interviews like I hope you never heard before. Without you, we can't do it. Thank you to all our socios, our members. We need you in order to do this. Love and kisses.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.